Hi, fellow geochemists and geochemistry enthusiasts. Welcome to Geochemisty, the only podcast for people who love geochemistry with a side of tea. Our mission is to inspire and to shed light on the topics not fancy enough to talk about at a conference, but really important to delve into. I'm your host, Sam Scher, and this week we're talking with Putra Sadikin using lithogeochemistry and spectroscopy to vector to mineralization, in the process talking about geochemistry diagrams and lithogeochemical modeling. For a great read and a good background on the topics, check out Hollis et al. 2021, Lithogeochemical and Hyperspectral Halos to Silver, Zinc, Gold Mineralization at the Nimbus Deposit in the Eastern Goldfields, Superterrain, Western Australia. Putra is the IOGAS software product manager at IMDEX. So to us geochemists, he's the person that mentors the IMDEX team and us on digital geoscience applications, including geochemistry and analytics trading. He's also in charge of the roadmap. So Putra, welcome to Geochemistry.
Thank you. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for having me.
It is a pleasure. So you've had now a pretty long career working with the IOGAS community, and recently you got your MBA. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Can you, you're welcome. Can you walk our listeners through your geochemistry journey and the evolution of your career?
Oh, thanks, Sam. So look, first of all, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a geochemist per se. I mean, I like geochemistry and IOGAS is a geochemistry software, but yeah, I mean, I guess I am a geochemist in a way, but you know, we have people with PhDs who are proper geochemists like Pin and so on. So I'm standing on the shoulder of giants, basically.
To be so honest, aren't we all?
Yes. So, you know, I started off studying land surveying and geology back at university. So that was at the University of Melbourne. I considered a career in construction as a construction surveyor. So I remember we had a class on, you know, the building Burj Al Dubai in the UAE.
Yes.
And just the construction of that is just amazing. And we had a guest lecturer who worked as a construction surveyor for that building. And I was like, wow, I want to do this. And then I went on to take more geology classes. And, you know, we had people coming in from the industry and talking about geophysics and application of geochemistry. And I was like, wow, I want to do this even more. And, you know, and, you know, I grew up, you know, loving computers, software, and especially the outdoors. And when the opportunity came for me to do vacation work with OZ Minerals, this was a while ago now, and I eventually did a master's based on my, well, not really based on my vacation work, but it's at the Prominent Hill IUCG deposit. So, you know, it's a very complex deposit, right? And it's there's a lot of applications of you know, applied geochemistry, you know, to find vectors to mineralization, that sort of thing. During the course of that project, which was sponsored by OZ Minerals and IO Global, that's when I met Dave Lowy for the first time. And so I did, you know, I did really enjoy that master's project. I was mentored by Dave, but also mostly by Heidi Pass. I don't know if you've met Heidi, but, you know, she's excellent, right? She's really good. So she taught me to you know, become, you know, somewhat of a geochemist, but, you know, it's a long road to get there, right? But you helped me get on the right foot, and basically just how to think about my data a bit more than just, you know, plotting things up on a scatter plot, that kind of thing. So at the end of my master's project, Dave Lowy said, you know, what are you doing after this? And he got me a job at IO Global, just to help out with making some classification diagrams and help some of our more senior geochemist consultants on projects and that sort of thing. And I went on to work, you know, more on the software side over the years. So I just ended up doing product support and helping out with the development of IAGS. And over years, you know, IA Global was acquired by IMDEX 2012. I stayed on and I did my MBA at 2020, actually. So that's when I, you know, sort of, there was at that point in my career where I was like, okay, I want to know more about, you know, how to build things. You know, I've always wanted to build things, you know, like make things that are useful. You know, I love the marketing and the business side of it, and I just want to know how we can, you know, create something that people will, you know, will love, that people will find useful. So really, I really like that business side of it and how to make things that are useful to people. And, you know, money always comes later with this sort of thing. And the MBA was pretty much the missing piece of the puzzle. So it's really hard to get from, you know, the customer point of view, which is, you know, I've been working in that product support and doing training and consulting and that sort of thing. And how do we get there to the money making part, you know? And I've always wanted to do an MBA. I've always, you know, thought about, you know, doing an MBA. And COVID was timely. Of course, I didn't know that there was going to be a global pandemic going on.
Okay.
But you know, look, it was really timely, right? Because there was really nothing else to do during those 2 years. Melbourne was in lockdown pretty much for most of the time, so attending classes was easy. It was mostly online for the most part. So we spent about, you know, about 14 out of the 24 months doing it online, which wasn't too bad. You know, I can just go to class straight after, you know, work kind of thing. So that was easy. And, you know, I went on to become a product manager for IAGS, just naturally, you know, make my way to that role. And I always view product management as intersection between the science. So, you know, the customers and their problems, the engineering, you know, I talk daily with our software engineers and try to think about the maths, because IAGS, to be honest, it has a lot more maths than chemistry. There's a lot of maths that goes into IAGS, so thinking about that a bit more, but also figuring out how it fits with the people, so stakeholder management, but also the business, so things like marketing, legal, sales, and that sort of stuff. So look, that's a really long-winded answer to how I got here. It's quite a long journey to get here, but it's been fun, I have to say.
I think that's really interesting, and it's a very different path than the ones that we've seen on the show thus far, and just showing how, well, first of all, you don't even go into geology to begin with, and then you wind up there, and then you end up meeting Dave and the IO Global team, and now 10 years plus later, here you are, and you've got an MBA, and it just goes to show that there's many different ways that you can take an appreciation and maybe perhaps a love of geochemistry and bring it to a different level for, now in your case, many people around the globe that use that product. So I think it's a good thing for definitely our young listeners to hear about.
Yeah. And, you know, I have to say something about geochemistry though. And it's that when I first got that offer, you know, because I wanted to do a master's in geology, and there were a few projects that were offered to me. One of them was, of course, the project that I did, Prominent Hill, which is a applied geochem project. But there was also an offer to do a master's on plankton stratigraphy. You know, so, you know, stratigraphy based on biostratigraphy, and there's also another project on melt inclusions and that sort of thing. So, you know, just weighing all of that up, and I didn't realize that there's going to be more maths than chemistry, especially with the project that I was working. I mean, of course, there were, you know, we had to think about reaction sequences and that sort of thing. When you're thinking about alteration, you know, that that alteration sequence, there's a chemical reaction that goes from, you know, if you want to convert something from your feldspars to something like a sericite and then from sericite to chloride. So you got to think of that in terms of the chemistry and the maths, but there's actually quite a lot more maths than I expected, which I actually really enjoyed. You know, especially, you know, doing land surveying, there was a lot of there was a lot of maths. I mean, there weren't super complex maths, but it was everywhere, right? It was there was a lot of manual linear algebra, and it's just basic first year maths, but it's just prevalent through the course, and it's fun. But it's surprising how that sort of maths that I use in land surveying actually directly applied to the geochem work that I did for my master's, which was cool and very useful, actually.
And I think you bring up a really interesting point, too, because with the uptake of IoGas, it's become very easy for people just to, you know, plug and play and not really think about the maths behind everything. And I'm not a big math person, so don't get me wrong, but the chemistry itself, you know, looking at alteration reactions, the thermodynamics, the kinetics behind it, like that's a very real thing. And I really appreciate you bringing it up because, you know, coming from, you know, IoGas itself, just having to have that understanding of the mass and the chemistry behind it is crucial towards picking the right diagram, your own diagrams, understanding what's going on in your deposit. So that's just definitely something that we'll be looking forward to talking about in just a little bit now.
Yeah.
So I think having talked about all that, is there any kind of tips or advice that you give our listeners that want to break into really any of the fields that you've talked about, but particularly geochemistry?
Yeah. So I think geochemistry as a science, or what it is in geology, especially in the mining industry. I couldn't speak for the oil and gas industry or other ancillary industries like environmental science and that sort of thing. But then in mining geology, especially and exploration geology, you know, when you're thinking about geochemistry, you have to think about where your data comes from. So I think that's quite important. Like if you want to break into geochemistry, as a science, it has evolved over the years. And I think because it's so much easier now to plot things up on a diagram and a plot. And I guess is, you know, it makes that process so much easier for people, you know, over the past 10 years, right? You know, you can just bring your assay data in and you can plot it in. But you know, if you want to get into geochemistry, you'll really need to first understand why you're doing it in the first place and whether whether plotting assay data will give you the right answer. So always approach, you know, your problem with the question first in mind, and maybe geochemistry and looking at assay data may not give you the right answer. But if they want to break into geochemistry as a student, you know, if they're really passionate about it, then they'll need to brush up on the various analytical techniques that's available. Because each one, you know, produce different results and, you know, they have different digests and everything. But also understand a bit about the maths behind it, especially because geochem data is compositional data. So, you know, in terms of analytical methods, I didn't fully understand all of these things when I was doing my master's, but the geochemistry group at Melbourne Uni, so we actually had a monthly book club. Well, it wasn't a book club, it's more like a journal club, right? It was strongly focused on analytical techniques. So, you know, back then we had a shrimp machine, you know, for zircon chemistry, and we had a couple of laser ablation machines as well. So there was a strong focus on analytical techniques and doing things right. So there was a focus on, you know, knowing where your data comes from, and or as I like to say it, how your sausage is made.
Okay.
But you know, if you're, you know, comfortable with that sort of thing, and if you like maths, of course you like exploration geochemistry. And the thing about geochem is that it pairs really well with multivariate statistics and quote unquote data science, which is, you know, if you've taken first year, second year stats, you know, it's, if you look at what data science techniques are available, you know, some of the more basic ones, they're basically multivariate statistics. And assay data can be unbiased, so it can be useful if you take into account certain things like how the sample is prepared, how it's analyzed, and how you interpret them eventually. So that's, again, that's not a long-winded answer to, you know, if you want to break into geochemistry, probably, yeah, just keeping those things in mind. I don't know if that will help anyone, but, you know, if you're looking for any tips, just send me a message on LinkedIn and yeah.
There you go, guys. In order to break into geochemistry, just send questions to his LinkedIn inbox. But seriously, I think you make some good points, because it's not just about, I think a lot of people that are listening here are wondering, do I need to get a master's? Do I need to get a PhD? Do I need to have this on my resume? Do I need to do this? But really at the heart of it, I think your points that are by understanding the methodologies that we use, by understanding, I'm never going to say math is basic, because, you know, math for me is just terrifying, but, you know, understanding the basics and the math that we do, the understanding the basic chemical principles, if you're able to grasp onto these concepts and then have a love for how it's applied in the field and go and see our talks, go and see courses that are put on by different consultants or consultancies, that's how really you start to get in there, starting to know people and starting to come into our world.
And you know, like, I guess one more tip is, especially if you're an undergrad student or a master's student, just take advantage of the journals that your institution is subscribed to, and just read as many geochem papers as you can. I certainly did lots of that when I was doing my master's. You know, we had subscriptions to pretty much everything, right? So, and I read papers that weren't even required for, you know, looking at ICG deposit, and just because they were interesting. So looking at alteration indexes that were more relevant to porphyry type deposit, for example. So that was, you know, quite eye-opening, right? So just take advantage of the resources that's available to you. And I think we're now living in a fantastic time where we have so many webinars and free webinars, so to say, you know, free webinars, easy way to gain journal articles online. You know, some authors make their papers available for free, that sort of thing. So, you know, take advantage of that sort of thing. Just spend time reading while you have the time and the freedom to do so, especially if you're a young student. I'm still young, by the way, but still.
Same. I'm still super young. Nobody else out there laugh. But I agree with that. It becomes really tricky when you're no longer in an institution where you have everything for free. But by having certain memberships to certain societies, and again, all the free webinars that always kind of are coming up. And it's just, I agree with you in the sense that, yeah, by me, every time I take on a new project, every time that I'm in the past when I was trying to understand something, it was just reading lots of different things, seeing lots of different ways that people were thinking about things and asking questions. And I think that's also what we're here for, guys. I love this introduction. Thank you for going into it in such length and detail. But now it's time to spill some tea. So let's see what you brought.
So I've listened to a couple of your podcasts, and I don't know if it's a language thing, but when I listen to tea, you know, do you mean gossip? Because I don't have any gossip.
I love it. Yes. Okay. So I lived abroad for a while, came back to the States, and had completely missed upon this thing. My friends were all like, what's the tea? You know, go to the hair salon. Hey, Sam, spill the tea. And I'm like, what is this thing? Urban Dictionary lays it out for you. Tea indeed is gossip. But I mean, so this could be anything, really. It doesn't have to be. Yeah. You could be as silly as Simon talking about how much time he really just spends at the bar when he goes and lives in certain places.
Well, you know, I gotta.
Yeah, or you could throw out something like Mike Whitbread did when he was talking about closing different things that were closing up shop over the world and how they were seeing when they were getting fired.
I know. I actually really enjoyed that. That's a very Mike Whitbread thing. You're like plotting things up on a PCA. That's probably before IOGAS, or was it after? I mean, he could have used anyway.
Anyway.
Look, but I prepared for this, right? Because I didn't have any gossip, but I got a somewhat funny and embarrassing story that I'd like to share.
This is tea. This is what we need. This is what we want. I love it. Spill.
All right. Right. So this is quite embarrassing. But look, when I was doing my master's, I was given access to IOGAS from early on in my project. And I had a license for a couple of months. You know, and I was struggling to do certain things in the program. So just for a bit of context for people who don't know about, I guess we have this thing called aliasing. So aliasing is basically a concept where IOGAS knows if you're bringing in assay columns, for example. So if you're bringing in something like SiO2%, IOGAS knows that it's silica oxide in weight percent. And that allows IOGAS to do fancy things in the background, like plotting things on a geochemical classification diagram. Right, so with that context aside, I didn't know that we could do that when I had my IOGAS license. So for a couple of months, I was manually calculating molar ratios from four asset ICP-MS data, so from SI percent, and converting that manually to silica in molar amount. So, and it's not as simple as that, because I had to basically create customized molar element ratio diagrams. And you know, if you've seen or read work by Cliff Stanley, you know, back in the 90s, he did a lot of work creating custom Pierce element ratios diagrams, which is basically a way to model alteration using mineralogy. So basically, I had to do all of this calculation in Excel for 2 months.
I am dead. Oh my goodness.
and I didn't know that it's super easy to do in IOGAS. So for 2 months, you know, and here's the
thing. It's literally like, automated.
I know. And you know, and I was looking at the and here's the embarrassing things. I was looking at the diagram menu in IOGAS, and there's a bunch of molar element ratio, and they were all grayed out. And I was like, okay, maybe they're all grayed out because I had a quote unquote student license. Maybe they didn't give me access to it. Maybe Dave's punishing me for some reason. I don't know. Maybe Dave doesn't like me. I don't know. Right. So I was like, okay, sure. I just gotta suck it up. And then I actually went to attend a real training course by Steve Sugden. So great guy. So he did an IOGAS training for OS Minerals, and I was invited. So it's a 2-day training. So first thing he showed us in that training was, this is how you alias your data columns. And I was like, oh.
No.
I was like, oh God, I wasted 2 months just crouching in front of my computer, calculating things manually. And you know, it's a bit of a humble brag, but I actually remembered, you know, molecular weight and that sort of thing, you know. Well, I put them in a whiteboard next to me, but at that point in time, you know, I can remember the molecular weight of SiO2 and TiO2 and all of those oxides, you know, by heart in order to calculate molar ratios and that sort of thing. Anyway, so spent 2 months suffering, and I didn't know that you could do it in an instant. But if there's a lesson, you know, to take from that, if there's any lesson to take from that, is that you got to ask questions, right? So don't be afraid, don't be too shy. I guess I was too prideful, but also maybe it's more of a cultural thing. I wasn't used to, you know, asking questions. So, you know, ask questions. Googling stuff doesn't substitute asking. You know, you just got to talk to people. You're more than welcome to disagree with people. You know, disagreement is okay when you're talking to others, when you're asking questions. There's no such thing as a silly question. So I get this all the time in training, right? And you know, when I showed them, okay, so first when you bring in an assay data, you gotta plot things up in a scatter plot. But you know, no one ever asked me why do we do that? Why do we need to plot things up on a probability plot or a histogram or a scatter plot? So people, you know, I don't know if it's something that, you know, other people have noticed, but you know, when you do training, when you explain things to people, I would expect, you know, more people to ask questions. You know, you just got to ask why certain methods are useful, especially when you're thinking about data science. So that's, I don't know, if there are things that grind my gears, is that, you know, when you're talking about data science, so-called, you know, data science, multivariate stats, whatever, in public, you know, people just don't ask if it's the right thing to apply on their data, if that makes sense. So, you know, when you're thinking of using things like principal component analysis, you got to think about running it on normally distributed data. And it's even trickier with geochem data because you get data with different ranges. You know, obviously SiO2, you know, your oxide values would have different ranges to your trace element values, that sort of thing. And obviously different data shape, different distribution. But, you know, I guess a takeaway from that, you know, slightly embarrassing story is that I should have asked questions earlier. People should ask more questions, especially during training and that sort of thing. I would like it if I do training and more people ask questions. I think some of the best trainings that I did in the past couple of years was when I did training for this one company, and the guy asked a lot of questions. They were good questions. There's no such thing as a bad question, but he asked a lot of questions, which was very enjoyable. It was good.
And I feel like the other thing too is that when you're younger, you tend to ask less questions because you're just like, I should know why when doing QA, QC, you plot up on this type of plot for this and you plot on this type of plot for this and then this means this or whatever. But just for anybody younger that's listening to this, just to know, most older people don't know the answers, but I think they kind of feel too old to ask these seemingly simple questions. So don't ever feel bad if you're in a training and you get thrown with, you know, you do this for this, or you do this for this, and you have a histogram here and a Tukey plot there. Like you say, you have to ask these questions because you are definitely not the only person in the room that knows the answer. The only person in the room that really knows the answer is probably the person giving the training. And even then, yeah. I've been stumped before, and I'll say, hey, give me a moment. I'll go back and I'll ask so-and-so. And I'll get you the right answer because that was a great question. And I'm not going to just lie to you here and just pretend like I know. So always, like you say, always, always, always ask questions.
Absolutely. And there's no such thing as a silly question or a bad question, right? I mean, in hindsight, when I was younger, you know, we're thinking about 10 to 15 years ago, I think that was probably the best time to ask lots of weird questions, especially when I was doing my master's. I certainly still have questions, especially about, you know, the work that I did during my master's that would have been more clear if I asked the right questions then. And the thing about asking questions is that it trains you to ask the right questions. So, and I think that's the most important part. You know, the more you ask questions, the better you get at asking the right questions.
Definitely. And that's key too for such a slew of things that we could probably go on a tangent for that. So maybe we should stop here and just say that this was really well done. Both your embarrassment, your ability to remember the molecular weights of obscure compounds to anybody outside of geochemistry. But now, you know, you learned your lesson and you asked questions, and that's what we should all do. So
that's right.
We'll leave it there. For those that have not read the Hollis et al. Paper, could you give a brief overview and explain why you think it's a great resource for the topics of discussion today, namely responsibly using geochemistry diagrams and how their correct application can enhance lithogeochemical modeling?
I stumbled upon this paper when I was looking for, you know, papers that uses IOGAS. That's part of what I do at work. I just scour the internet for papers that references gas, just because. But also because it's quite nostalgic. So some of the methods that were used to this kind of reminds me when I did my master's. Obviously, the paper is quite interesting. It discusses bimodal hybrid VMS deposit. So bimodal in its igneous composition, but also you get a bit of that epithermal kind of trend going on within the deposit. But the thing is, like, regionally, the distal alteration coming closer towards deposit is classic VMS type sort of pattern and signatures that you would expect. I really like how it uses lithogeochem and hyperspectral data in conjunction together. Because it really explains the alteration composition and the paragenetic sequence quite well. I can see that, you know, some of the classic things that were highlighted in this paper are the vectors to mineralization from the trend from that sericite muscovitic to paragenetic composition in the sericite. And I like how we got a couple of alteration box plots in there, which we can talk about in a bit more detail.
Very well. Then looking just at the abstract of this paper, the authors have hit this deposit with multiple exploration indices, like you said, mass balance equations, infrared data. And we're talking about rocks that range, as you said, from slightly unaltered to highly altered volcanics, breccias, and conglomerates. Is there anything here that immediately makes you want to read the methodology section of the paper instead of going straight to the discussion?
So I'm always interested when there's a paper that has a combination of rocks that they analyze themselves with a combination of company data, which is exactly the case in this paper. So again, data collection method matters with everything geochemistry. So lithogeochem, and you know, when you're talking about the whole rock analysis of using fusion, a combination of fusion and something like ICP-MS for trace elements, is quite useful for mass balance calculation and proper use of things like molar element ratio analysis. But you know, they're comparatively more expensive. And as a result, you know, we only see them from 6 holes in this paper and only for a few hundred samples, right? So the company that the author referenced to in this paper collected the 4-ACID and portable XRF data. So 4-ACID, you know, has been known to be quite useful for identifying broad trends, portable XRF too, to some extent. And these type of data, you know, with 4-ACID geochem, you know, guys like Scott Haley does this quite well. It's really useful for looking at large scale trend in magmatic fractionation, but also for boundary picking. And it can get a bit tricky when you're using things like portable XRF for lithological identification, simply because of under detection and that sort of thing. But the fact that we have high logger data as well, but you know, we only get them from 4 holes. But what that means is, if you're combining different types of data together, even if you don't have a good representation of the entire deposit or some of the more distal samples, with the overlap of data, you get a lot more to go with. So you have things that support each other. And this overlap, while it doesn't represent the entire extent of the project area spatially, it gives us a bit more to think about when you think about, you know, what's the most cost-effective way of collecting data that represents variations for the things that you're looking for. So for example, if you're looking for alteration zonation, what sort of data would you collect? And if you're looking for, just in broad terms, rock type classification, what sort of data would you collect? And what's that cost to benefit, you know, an analysis, which would be more appropriate for your data? And one thing that I would ask, you know, why I jumped to the methodology section is, you know, I've always wanted to, every time I read this sort of paper, I want to see if they have done any correction on any of the data. So for example, if you have things like below detection limit values, what did they do to the below detection limit data? And if you have portable XRF data, do you correct the XRF values? Do you adjust them to something else? And I guess, you know, looking at the paper, yes, the author did the correction on the portable XRF data, which is quite a reasonable thing to do for, you know, systematic offset. But, you know, one thing to keep in mind is that the XRF data was corrected based on 4-ACID. And I wasn't sure, just based on the paper, if they were collected on the same sample medium or on a different sample medium. So I've always read the methodology section of the paper, maybe not first. You know, you got to read the abstract and the conclusion first, sort of, you know, when you create a paper like this. But I'm always drawn to the methodologies, you know, going back to that point about how the sausage is made kind of thing.
No, I agree. I think for me, because I'm always looking for new techniques as well, I'm always very drawn to the methodology section. And then also it's not like I'm always looking for people to be wrong. And I don't think that I know necessarily better than other people, but for things particularly like this, where you're combining so many different types of data, and it's just like, are you just doing this out of a place of, out of just throwing them together? Or are you doing it from a place of knowledge where you're taking care to make sure that you can combine them in a way that makes sense? So even I had a question maybe last week or a few weeks ago from a student from the University of Western Ontario, and he was just asking me about merging historical geochemical databases and doing things like leveling and when would that be appropriate or not. And this is something that I just found with this paper because it was for acid, PX or F, and whole rock, but also they had I think the four acid data was from two different labs, from Intertect and ALS. So yeah, it wasn't,
that's right. Yeah.
At that point, it was just like, what exactly are we doing here to make sure that this data is good to move forward with? And what are your thoughts on that?
I guess, just coming back on that point, right? When I read the methodology section, it's not so much to point that the author was wrong or if they did anything bad or anything, but it's more wrong. How much of the project area is represented by the data they collect, and what sort of precision and accuracy that we're looking for in each method, and what does that tell us about the data, and what can we expect from that sort of data when we start plotting them up using things like classification diagrams? Because coming back to that point, some diagrams were made using methods that may be different to what you're plotting your data on. Some diagrams like alteration box plot, for example, that were plotted using the geochemical assay method. So, we're probably dealing with, a combination of fusion, XRF and ICP-MS with the trace elements. But when you're looking at plotting portable XRF data on that sort of diagram, would you get an accurate result? Or do you need to create custom diagrams? Some of those things to keep in mind. And on leveling, that's a tricky question. When we do training for IOGAS, leveling is something that's a bit tricky to teach because there's not enough good data out there to showcase this quite well. But an example that I had from a client that I gave training to a couple of years ago, is when we level based on the variation in the sample size. So, they were collecting portable XRF data, and it's the sieve size, and just correcting for the variation. So if you flag it in the data, then you can level up to that variation. But when leveling, you're just going to make sure that you know where you're starting from and what you want to get out of it. It can get a bit hairy, and just keep in mind that when you're looking at level data, obviously you cannot plot them on geochem classification diagram because you're looking at leveled values, right? So things to keep in mind.
Yeah, it's a very good point. I almost think a lot of times in lieu of leveling, and it depends, obviously it's case to case, but a lot of times I'll apply a similar methodology to each data set separately and then just kind of bring them together in the end, if that makes more sense to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, leveling is pretty, it just seems like a really nice and easy solution, but it's actually can be quite tricky.
I would just flag them in the data, right? And doesn't matter how you plot your geochem data, but as long as you have information on your in your assay table, if you have information on how the data was collected, so all that metadata information is what we encourage people to have when they start plotting things up, especially in IOGAS. Just have information on the geology, sampling method, sample size, even things that you may not think is important at the start. Just have them in the database. There's no harm. Just collect as much metadata as you can and try to flag it as you do in your interpretation. I think that's more important than leveling.
Talk about embarrassing. I'll share my own embarrassing story. I was working with a client and I just couldn't figure out. I was just like, oh my goodness, it looks like there's three or four different of these. I think it was like a basalt or something like that. And it looks like there's three or four different generations of it. And because I had put in my metadata in there and I was just flicking through and I was just showing my client because we were just talking through it and everything. It was early stages of the interpretation, but they just suggested that I flick on the column for in IOGAS of the what the analytical method was. And it was just the two drill holes that showed up being, as like basalt three or something like that, were in fact just a different, it was a different lab or so, a similar technique, but a different lab. So both for acid, but it was just a different lab. And it was just, I was like, oh my goodness, like, can I even call myself a geochemist at this point? I was like, all right, I'm out.
I mean, I get another story, like just a quick one. It's like there, I saw one quite recently. So that this is with portable XRF detection time. There's quite a difference between 30 seconds and 50 seconds.
Okay.
Same rock, but different cluster. So, you know, so you get half the hole that was, you know, accidentally analyzed with a longer detection time, 50 seconds per bead. So that ended up showing quite different, even though they're geologically the same. They're all the same rock all the way down the hole. So, but they show up as different when you plot them up. And when you look at them, oh, they're quite different. They must be different rock type. And then you plot the reading time on it. It's like, oh, yeah, there you go.
So. There you go. Oh, my God. Every time it's so embarrassing every time. But yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You think you're discovering something amazing and it's really just, okay, right, metadata.
Yeah.
So there you go. Getting back to the paper, though, and another thing, because I love talking about being careful using diagrams and indices. Yep. One of the things that I noticed, and just the geology background, so guys, also just read all parts of the paper. All parts of the papers are fun for different reasons. Anyway, I'm reading the geology background. One line in there that states, all rocks have been subjected to lower green schist facies metamorphism. So when you see something like that, or if you're in the field and you see that you have some metamorphism going on and you're looking for like a big alteration system or something like that, what are your thoughts? You know, what kind of just bleeps and flags in your mind when you see some of diagrams and indices that are being applied for this, right?
Yeah, so this is where it gets a bit hairy, right? Because when you're thinking about, so if you're going back to the context of lower green schist facies metamorphism, you got to come back to the data and think, you know, the sentence said all rocks. Okay, so does this mean the felsic, both the felsic and the mafic rocks, and also all the other sediments, all the layers of sediments that we're looking at within the hole, and the brecciated rocks as well? So when you're thinking of this in terms of mineralogy, you know, what sort of minerals that you would expect to see in a green schist facies metamorphism, especially in mafic rocks, and what would that look like in the plots that we have in the paper? The green schist metamorphism, the minerals that you would see in there are represented through plotting, you know, the samples in the least altered box. So when you read the original paper of the altered box plot, so that's by Ross Large in 2001 or 2000. You know, you can see that in there it says if you have rocks that were subjected to green schist metamorphism, they would plot within the least altered box. But then again, in the paper, he refers to rocks from particular deposits, so not necessarily something that would necessarily apply to the Nimbus geology. But, you know, when you're looking at the paper, I would prefer to see, you know, alteration index versus the carbonate, chloride, pyrite index, or CCPI, with the geochemical data, and modify the least altered box in that plot based on, you know, distal lithology from drill hole number 15. Because when you look at this type of alteration index, and you got to think of the box plot as a combination of two alteration index. So alteration index, which is a measure of conversion of feldspars to sericite, and then to, you know, it's a function of magnesium and potassium gain and the loss of elements associated with feldspar. So it captures, you know, intensity of footwall alteration. And CCPI, so the other axis, the x-axis, is more of a measure for chloride and carbonate alteration. So development of iron, magnesium, chloride, carbonate, and of course, iron, sulfur, so things like pyrite, right? So it's a fairly mineralogical, you know, type of plot, but it describes a very narrow, you know, band of alteration sequence. And when you think of, you know, things that happen in lower Grinius fastest metamorphism, you know, it can get a bit hairy using that type of alteration box plot to describe lower Grinius fastest metamorphism. And that's why rocks that were exposed to that type of metamorphism would plot within the least altered box, but they wouldn't necessarily plot outside of this box in the altered zone, because this diagram was made to describe alteration process, but not necessarily the variation between metamorphosed rocks and fresh rocks. And some of the signatures here that's represented in metamorphism may be more subtle, and it may not be represented that well using the box plot. I mean, you can, but they probably would plot inside the least altered box, if I have to say so myself.
Yeah, I think it just goes to show that you have to be considering the rocks that you're using versus the types of kind of, I don't want to say canned, but like pre-made indices or diagrams to make sure that they're fit for purpose before even starting. We talked with Pam on the show a number of months ago now about how to create your own diagrams, yep. Which he is, you know, big fan of.
Yeah.
But I think that can also be daunting to a lot of people. So it's kind of, you know, you get into the world of IOGAS, which is incredible for exploring for data, but it's also just like for users, you know, just because it says that it can do this, yep. You have to understand, as you reference, the where the box plot came from, right? From the paper, yep. From 2001. Like, you have to understand where it came from in order to apply it properly. So
yeah, absolutely. And you know, like with this type of paper and with other papers as well, you know, I think some of the dangers is that you would use this sort of diagram, especially the alteration box plot, on sedimentary rocks and even mafic rocks. So what's interesting about the alteration box plot is that the intended use for it is on felsic rocks in VMS type deposits. And simply that's because if you plot mafic rocks on an alteration box plot, the CCPI values, so in one of the axes, it would be plotting way too high, right? So it would plot close to altered, the altered part of the alteration box plot. And it may be misleading. You know, if you plot mafic rocks on this type of plot, you would think, oh, my mafic rocks are super altered. And really that may not be the case. It's just they have the precursor rocks, they just have naturally higher iron and magnesium. And that's why they're plotting quite higher in that excess value, in that CCPI value. So it may be misleading in a way. So it's knowing, you know, what type of rocks that you would plot it on that diagram. And again, going back to the topic of metadata in your data, having good metadata in your assay file is incredibly important. You got to know what you're plotting and what you're plotting it on.
Yeah. And just to kind of like finish out this point, with all these indices and array of plots, because I think also the author did a really good job of just showing how they built up towards, yep, using these plots. So it was just, they had a lot of bivariate plots where they're showing different patterns that they've observed. You can imagine they probably had 1,000 other plots that they had looked at while looking at their data before getting to these plots that were more in their discussion section, say. So I'm wondering, do you favor a similar workflow? Like, when you get a data set from a client, how is it that you start to look at your data?
First of all, you know, when receiving a data set from a client, you know, you would try to find out what analytical method was used to get those data. So that's number one. Number two, you would plot things up in a probability plot, maybe histogram, that's just to check the distribution of it before proceeding, and trying to use simple things like scatter plots, you know, just using a scatter plot matrix and try to find the relationship between elements. So, you know, with this data set, right, the dacite and the basalt, they're geochemically very different. So they're literally on opposite ends. So actually, this just a shout out. Thanks to the author of this paper for providing the data set. I had a play around with it. It's a great data set just to illustrate processes and things in IAGAS. So, so it's really quite helpful to get a better understanding of the paper using that data set. But having good metadata allows us to, you know, when you do that initial, what we call univariate analysis at the start, so looking at things using those type of graphs, can tell you a lot more about the data even before you start putting it up on diagrams. And then once you know once you can see that you see variations in elements like sodium, calcium, iron, and magnesium, you know, the elements that are used in that alteration box plot, for example, then you can see that it will tell you something when you start plotting them up on an alteration box plot. So looking at the data first before putting it in context, or you can go either way, right? But you know, my preferred approach is to look at your data without diagrams first, but putting it in the context of your geology. So again, metadata is important. Flag it based on your metadata columns, text columns, and then using diagrams to get a bit of a better context to the geology based on geochemical classification regimes.
It's really good advice. At any point, do you start to think, this looks like a good candidate for me to start building my own diagrams to?
I guess
what would that point be?
I mean, 100%. I mean, you know, if we just step out of the alteration box plot as an example, so if you're thinking about identifying, for example, the rock types, for example. So this data set, you know, when you look at the rocks that will log as dacite and the rocks that will log as basalt, they plot as two different trend lines on a titanium versus zirconium plot. So they actually have two separate linear trends. And of course you would, because it's just something that you would see in a bimodal population, like bimodal igneous population like that. So that's a really good basis to create a custom classification diagram that says, okay, rocks from this type, rocks from this project, you have a polygon that represents basalt composition, and you have a polygon that represents more dacitic intermediate composition, things like that. They're quite easy to set up, and that's a really good place to start, especially with so-called immobile elements.
Yeah, totally agreed. And then just thinking one more path down that line, I get a lot of feedback about people that are concerned that they're only using elements, for example, and they're not using ratios, and they're just like, but it seems more right, because I always see people that give geochem webinars and they always have ratios. What would you necessarily recommend to people like that? I mean, I would say don't be super concerned that you can't use a ratio here, but somebody that's seen a lot of people over the past decade plus, like, what would you recommend to them?
Right. So ratios, that's a couple of things, right? So ratios were initially used to mitigate the effects of closure. And I think Tim talked about this, and Mike talked about this a bit as well. But ratios were, you know, were quite useful to mitigate the effects of closure. But then guys like Cliff Stanley, they would use ratios to, obviously, to use in Pierce element ratio diagrams. So it's molar element ratios, which describes, you know, if you're looking at, for example, a Pierce element ratio of potassium over titanium or zirconium versus aluminium over titanium or zirconium. So depending on what element is conserved in a deposit, that's the denominator you would use. Titanium or zirconium tends to be conserved, but not always. And, you know, you would use that type of diagram to describe an alteration sequence. Well, not really alteration sequence, but each of the trend line in that diagram, so a line that goes from the origin, represents, you know, ratio of potassium to aluminium, for example. And the reason why the denominator as a conserved element works in that case is because you're only describing the absolute the absolute magnitude of change in that particular element. So for example, you can use a molar element ratio diagram to describe an alteration reaction, but also the intensity of alteration. So the further you go up the abyssa, I don't know if I pronounce it right, but if the further you go up the line of a slope in a Pearson ratio diagram, that essentially describes more intensity of that particular element, more intensity of that particular mineralogy. So things like that. But when people when people see ratios being used in in webinars and this sort of thing, I guess it gets a bit tricky, right? You know, I wouldn't discourage people to use element ratios, but you gotta know the context of what you're working with. So with Pearce element ratios, with Pearce element ratios where you have the conserved element in the denominator, you will want to know that the element you use in the denominator is conserved in your deposit. So that's how you use that type of diagram. And for things like general element ratios, so a particularly famous one is one by Davies and Whitehead. I think it's from 2004. So it describes alteration mineralogy reaction in a typical, porphyry and epithermal type sort of deposit. So you have all your feldspars in one end and all your clay minerals on the other end kind of thing. So knowing the right diagrams for certain contexts, and if you've seen people do the same type of diagram with the same type of data that you have on a similar deposit to you, then you can have a play around with it and see if it works with your data. But just keep in mind that some of these diagrams were created with possibly a different method to you. So with that being said, if you're using Aqua Regia or portable XRF data, would you be able to get a good sense of using a Pearson ratio or ratio diagrams? Maybe, but just gotta keep that in mind of the digest and if it digests elements that are used in this type of diagram. But when you're talking about going back to Pim's podcast episode, which I really enjoyed, so he was talking about trace element ratios, right? So trace element ratios for igneous type classification is quite useful, but you just got to know that the digest, the analytical method you're working in, has digested the minerals that host these elements in the first place. Otherwise, your rocks will be plotting in a funny place in this diagram, and it wouldn't be as useful as you think it would.
I think that really satisfies the meat of that question and beyond. Look at you. You're made for this kind of platform. It's all that, all those questions that you've gotten from all those years of doing the IOGAS presentations and webinars and stuff. The one thing that I wanted to comment on this paper is that I think it does an amazing job of building on prior work. I didn't go back and read all the references, but you can see in the way that they've built on in reference to work done in the past on Nimbus. And I think that it also does an excellent job of laying out the geology and petrographic observations that are critical for a really good geochemical analysis, because I'll say as well that just having your four asset data, yes, you can do a lot with it, but not having those other pieces of work does make a really, really robust interpretation challenging.
Yep.
And also, the authors, I think, do a great job of explaining their observations of the geochemistry, the mineralization, the halos that they see. And to me, this lays a really strong foundation for starting a lithogeochemical model. So could you first define what a lithogeochemical model is and then just tell us why they're useful?
Yeah, so I tend to view a lithogeochemical model as using geochemistry to describe the formation of a rock. So just starting from the precursor rocks, from the protoliths in more distal rocks all the way up to alteration, and how alteration can be explained by the geochemistry, and how mineralization can be explained through the assay data. So the absence and presence of certain elements, that's what I think a lithogeochemical model is. I think there's a strong focus on alteration reaction and how that's manifested in the geochem data. But I think with lithogeochem model, right, it's everything that has to do with the rocks that you're looking at with respect to the geochemistry. but it's not to be looked at in isolation only. So you will not, you will need to look at your little geochem. So you will need to look at your geochemistry data with everything else. So you're going to look at it with thin section photos, fusual observation, core photographs, structural geology, just a measurement of your structural orientation, how your fault is oriented, all the geophysics signal, downhole geophysics as well. So if you have downhole gamma data, might be useful, magnetic susceptibility and resistivity. And of course, you know, nothing beats looking at your geochem with fusual logging. So fusual logging can be biased, you know, as you know, but core photography, you know, may it's not that biased because, you know, you're looking at the photos, especially if your photograph condition is consistent. So just a shout out to the Data Rock guys. You know, those guys are doing amazing work just with automated, you know, core imagery and core photographs. So I think that will reduce, you know, the bias in involved in looking at that type of data. But I was thinking about this, you know, a couple of days ago, and I don't think you're supposed to be looking at geochem data on its own, especially without metadata. So if you're looking at just a table of numbers, you plot them up in IAGS or whatever, you can come up with really bad interpretation if you're only looking at assay data without context. Like really bad. Like you would plot them up on an alteration box plot and say, these rocks are unaltered. And then you look at the data and it turns out it's just distal sandstone, that kind of thing.
I think when a lot of people hear this term of a lithogeochemical model, they're just thinking that, okay, their visual logging is so bad. They know that. And the savior to this will just be using the geochemistry just to, for them to bring everything back to a point of truth. This actually is basalt. This is actually a dacite. This is actually this rock. And now, okay, now we've made up a true stratigraphy just using chemistry. And it's a bit of an overreach. It's not to say that great work can't be done. I'm working on something akin to that right now, but yeah. I'm also working in conjunction with a really talented team of geologists who have done an excellent job of logging, which is guiding the ability to be able to say, okay, this is the basalt. This is, I forgot what their other rock is. That's kind of looks like a basalt, but anyway, okay, and we can separate these two like this. You could put up a confusion matrix, right, and say that here, you know, this one, even though you identified it as a basalt, it's actually really this rock. Absolutely. And while geochemical data is really powerful and you can make a great 3D model of your geology better by putting in geochemistry into it, just having it by itself, I think personally is an overreach.
Mm.
But it is a powerful data set. And you could do better.
It is a powerful way of looking at the data. I mean, a good set of geochem data is unbiased, right? I mean, it can tell you a lot about the rock, but you will still need to look at it in conjunction with core photography, thin section. And I think it's quite useful to capture really high quality other data types. So high quality fusual logging, high quality thin section photos, spectral data just on a couple of key drill holes, and you use that almost as a training data set that you can apply on a larger scale.
Yeah, and I do a lot of work with the integration of hyperspectral and geochemistry data, and that for me I absolutely love all the work too that people have been doing, with whether they be in university settings or with consultancies out there that are doing all this work with core photography and hyperspectral imaging data to derive textures out of it. I mean, that's really, I mean, now I think we're getting into a bit of a philosophical thing. Anyway, it is to say that the lithogeochemical model, in my opinion, is powerful, but it's not without training it and using other data sets to make it into something that makes sense.
Yep. Absolutely.
And my last question for you here is just, how would you take the investigation at the Nimbus deposit and then take it to the next level for a client? Because like I said, I think these guys have done a huge job of building on what had been done in the past, but I think there's still ways to keep on going. What do you think your next step would be with this data set?
Yeah, I think these guys have done a really great job, you know, with the paper and with the work they've done. It's very, very comprehensive. I guess you know, it's one thing that I wish I have done for my master's thesis in a way, just that level of detail in the data, in the paper was it's quite great, right? But some of the next steps that I would approach this is probably splitting interpretation by the different assay type. I know they have done it to some extent, but and I wonder if there's merit in, you know, splitting interpretation by the different assay methods and just doing it in a bit more detailed manner, and maybe using Pierce Elman, creating customized Pierce Elman ratio diagrams based on mineralogy, so you can use that to describe, you know, pretty specific alteration sequence, and you can see, because what you can do is basically you can plot your distal rocks on one end, and then you can see if your more altered rocks are plotting on the other end. So you're creating two end members of unaltered mineralogy and altered mineralogy on the other axis, basically, and you can see if your data is plotting in close to either axis, that sort of thing. And you know, this geochem data is compositional data, so you know, you got to be wary of closure in the data. I'm not going to talk about closure in this talk, but you know, just if you're, this is especially useful if you start to look at things like plotting things up in a scatter plot, especially with altered rocks. You know, if you're thinking of things in the context of closure, you know, you would use things like centered log ratio or, you know, inverse log ratio, that sort of thing, to mitigate the effect of closure. But, you know, probably some of the next steps that I don't see are covered in the paper is to use multivariate stats. So unsupervised tools like principal component analysis, probably things like UMAP, so uniform manifold approximation and projection, TSNE, so that's a stochastic neighbor embedding. Those are basically unsupervised dimension reduction technique to find groupings in the data. So, you know, the four asset data in this paper, there are thousands of data points, and plotting things up on using unsupervised analysis like that would be quite useful to find underlying clusters in the data with, you know, just independent to the groupings that may exist, and just trying to see if certain groups can also be split up into subgroups, for example. But also using supervised analysis methods like decision tree. So decision trees are quite good because if you are confident in your visual logging, especially if you're using it on a couple of, you know, what we call key drill holes. So, or, you know, what we call type drill holes. So drill holes that you are incredibly familiar with the geology and confident with the geological interpretation. And you would use something like a discriminant projection analysis or decision tree to find characteristics in your data that can explain the variation in your groups. So you can, you know, for example, determine if your samples that were logged as ore bodies have higher amount of certain elements or a decreased amount of certain elements. So this sort of supplements, you know, the work that the author has done with the isochron ratios, isochron plots, but also all the plots that I have used in the paper. So it's just, it's not to replace what they've done, but it's to build up further, you know, further information from the work that they've done. But also, you know, with the high logger data, they can use something like wavelet tessellation in the raw high logger data to pick out boundaries, for example, because some of those data can be quite noisy, for example. And if they use XRF data, I see that they collected every meter or half a meter, you know, they can use the wavelet tessellation algorithm to smooth out the signal and find boundaries better. But also, you know, some of the next steps will always have to look at things in context with the geology. So for example, why is a certain cluster different to the other cluster? And can we explain this geologically or through the different sampling or analysis methods? So look, there's quite a lot of things that can be done, you know, after the fact. There always is, right? You know, when you're looking at projects like this, especially with a good data set, the sky is the limit. And the only limitation is really budget and time, as with these things.
And maybe a little bit of imagination. But yeah, no, I think you I loved your different suggestions. I thought it was so interesting. You just see all the work that was put into it already, building on other people's work. And I looked at that one too, and I was like, ooh, yeah, this is what I would try next or something like that. And
yeah,
but I think it's kind of the difference too between an academic study and something that you would be delivering to a client as well. So
yeah. And, you know, like delivering to a real client, especially when you're doing consulting project for a client, you just gotta, if you're giving an advice, what sort of things to do next, you know, trying to think of it in the context of what sort of data point that you collect is as least expensive as possible to the client that can get the most value for them.
I definitely hear that. Well, thank you so much for listening to Geochemistry, and a big thanks to Putra for stopping by the show, dishing some great tea, actually, and providing really great insight into the application of geochemical diagrams and modeling. Thanks to our sponsor, LKI Consulting, and to It's Water and Coma Media for our music. And if you want to learn more about the show or submit a request beyond the show, recommend a geochemist to chase up, please go to our website at geochemistry.com. And I'm looking forward to chatting with you all next month.
Thanks, Sam. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.